right? Early, like, 18th century and late 17th century of the fictions of Daniel Defoe. Because the show that I did with Logo a while back, we talked about that some. Robinson Crusoe is really a very crucial metaphor in the development of market imperialism. It's like the heart and soul of it or something, like, poetically. Once you read Robinson Crusoe, you'll get it, everything that we're talking about. Marx definitely agrees about Robinson Crusoe. He says, "As political economists are fond of Robinson Crusoe's stories, let us first look at Robinson on his island. Undemanding though he is by nature, he still has needs to satisfy, and must therefore perform useful labors of various kinds. He must make tools, knock together furniture, tame llamas, fish, hunt, and so on. Of his prayers and the like, we take no account here, since our friend takes pleasure in them and sees them as recreation. Despite the diversity of his productive functions, he knows that they are only different forms of activity of one and the same Robinson, hence only different modes of human labor. Necessity itself compels him to divide his time with precision between his different functions. Whether one function occupies a greater space in his total activity than another depends on the magnitude of the difficulties to be overcome in attaining the useful effect aimed at. Our friend Robinson Crusoe learns this by experience, and having saved a watch, ledger, ink, and pen from his shipwreck, he soon begins, like a good Englishman, to keep a set of books. His stock book contains a catalog of the useful objects he possesses, of the various operations necessary for their production, and finally, of the labor time that specific quantities of these products have on average cost him. All the relations between Robinson and these objects that form his self-created wealth are here so simple and transparent that even Mr. Seldley Taylor could understand them. And yet, those relations contain all the essential determinants of value."
Everybody's read Robin. Yeah, everybody's. Yeah. The whole world is contained within the text of Robinson Crusoe. It's funny to contrast that with the 70s vision. There's a essay that I've been, like, really kind of obsessed with for a while, and it's by Fisher Black. And Fisher Black is the guy who he helped develop what's called the Black-Scholes formula. And that's the Black-Scholes formula is at the center of the book you recommended, the engine, yeah. not a camera, because it's the Black-Scholes formula that prices futures. He wrote a thing in the 70s. Yeah, it was in 1971, and it was called Towards a Fully Automated Stock Exchange. And I just sent you the cover of it in the Signal chat.
Oh, yes. Oh, that is a cool cover. No way.
It's got this machine, this bizarre kind of like anachronistic machine, and it's got all these elaborate hoses that are, I guess, attached to various stock people's desks. It kind of almost has a foreboding quality, like one of the people on the cover has a very pensive look on their faces.
The cover looks like it's like a Japanese tentacle sex monster. That's what it looks like. He knows something's coming.
Do you know Leo Melamed? He was the chairman of the Mercantile Exchange in the late 60s and in the 70s. It was under him that the Mercantile Exchange created the International Monetary Market, which was like the global financial futures. But the reason I mentioned this is because he wrote a sci-fi novel in the 80s called The Tenth Planet. And in The Tenth Planet, there's like this big supercomputer called Putrol.
Oh, this owns...
And it runs all the planets that exist in this galaxy, right? But the thing is Leo Melamed had overseen the introduction of early internet and advanced computing into the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. That was necessary for the international monetary market to be done because you needed global interconnection for communication in order to do that. So I think it's really curious that it was in the 80s, I believe, that he ended up reading this book about the computer that runs the world. And I found like a little book that he wrote. You know, he's talking about it. He talks about how like computers empirically will someday run this entire show, and kind of suggests that he was extrapolating his Chicago Mercantile Exchange experience to his sci-fi computer utopia.
Is there an actual definition that the CME uses to define interstellar? Is that where you got that from? Is that in the books there?
Galactic computers.
Galactic computers.
It runs five planets, KB. This is important.
Oh my god, but is that actually galactic? That's not that much. That's not many planets.
I guess not. I mean, for a computer, I don't know. I haven't read the novel. I've just read his description of it. So, and he calls it galactic.
You haven't read it, huh? Well, I don't blame you. It's incredibly rare, but what's this? Oh, I have a copy of The Tenth Planet by Leo Milamed in my hands right now. When Human Equals Alien reads the cover here. So let's just see if the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has any information to give us about the wonderments of outer space. I'm going to read from Chapter 9 of The Tenth Planet. Nearly 128 billion stars occupied the Galadorian galaxy housing the Galotian star system. Its star, Zosma, inhabited the farthest reaches of the galaxy, near the end of one of its spiraling arms. Zosma was a solitary middle-aged star shining with a constant brightness. The planetary system it graced with its light contained 14 major planets. 5 were gaseous giants and 4 were frozen balls of ice. Brr. The other 5 were inhabited by the Galanoid race known as Galotia. Zamos, the planet toward which the dance was destined, and its nearest neighbor, Galos, were known as the Inner Twins. Not only were they of similar size, their atmosphere, geography, and climate were virtually identical. The physical similarity between these two planets was a natural wonderment. Each contained similar major and minor saltwater oceans, millions of freshwater lakes and rivers, regions of fertile land and mountain ranges. Most important, the atmosphere on each was endowed with a plentiful supply of natural oxygen. The differences between the twin planets could be found in their society and culture. Zamotians took great pride in being the first to colonize. The motivation of their forefathers was to build a better, more enlightened social structure. The results were confounding. Zamos represented the best and worst of their civilization, the most beautiful and ugly. Amiable and unfriendly, civilized and savage. It was the self-appointed guardian of world morality, and by any measurement, the prima donna of the system. Citizens of Galos, on the other hand, had no doubt their own planet represented the central cog of Galotia. What the fuck is this guy even talking about? I swear to God. Well, I'm sure that he knows best. I mean, he ran the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
In 1987, he introduced something that was called Globex. And that is the global trading system that it was the first electronic platform for future contracts. And it used the Reuters technology. So, I mean, this is literally a global computer that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange was implementing. So, I don't know.
Don't you just hate that?
Yeah, I do.
It just makes it all seem so much worse that it's all based on some L. Ron Hubbard type guy writing this terrible like pulp science fiction novel that he's coming up with this global computer control system. There's a great book that I would recommend here, Early Financial Fictions. You remember that one? Did I show you that? A really entertaining read, first of all, because you don't really often think about a lot of this stuff. It's called Reading the Market by Peter Knight. It takes place in that era of when they were really building up the stock market and when futures trading starts, because it's actually the Chicago Mercantile Exchange where they start doing the futures for wheat. And that's 1898 is when that's founded. Back in that era, really nobody was engaging in like buying financial instruments at all, except for the banking houses and stuff, merchant bankers. It was through this instrument of this romanticizing financial fiction sort of kicked off our whole love affair with the stock market. Back then, they actually had these things called bucket houses, and it was a place where non-wealthy people could go to get in on the action of the stock market, but it didn't involve actually buying any stocks. It was more like horse race betting, where you were just going to like a bookie and like betting on whether the line went up or not. This is when Wall Street Journal and all these financial magazines came about. So this Peter Knight book covers financial reporting and financial journalism. But then also there was literal romances written about stock market, the world of the stock market, like stories, novels, romanticized in all these crazy ways. But the one that I really like from the oldie days, around 1900, is this book by Peter Knight talks about this one novel called The Pit.
What I think the promise of a fully automated stock exchange, this is a stock exchange that runs without any human input in buying or selling. What's the function of the pit at that point? There is no more pit at that point. You just have the continuous trading of your supercomputers.
There's definitely a connection there of what you said about like all that, the frenzy of the pit being exhausted out of it. It's no longer this orgiastic animal matrix to rave. Now, you know, really unpleasant rape machine. And on that note, here's a audiobook version of a long section of The Pit by Frank Norris from 1906 about the romance of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange trading wheat futures. You're really welcome. This is about 10 minutes long. And if you can't handle it, just log off, just close this, because it doesn't count. You can't skip this and then listen to the rest of this podcast and then act like you get it or something. No, this is it. This is a critical part. So trust me. This is going to tie it all together for you. So just sit back and enjoy. And we'll be back for the next section of this very special, amazing episode of the Suitcast after this word from our sponsor, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
The Pit.
And abruptly, midway between two phases of that music drama of passion and romance, there came to Laura the swift and vivid impression of that other drama that simultaneously, even at that very moment, was working itself out close at hand, equally picturesque, equally romantic, equally passionate. But more than that, real, actual, modern, a thing in the very heart of the very life in which she moved. And here he sat, this Jadwin, quiet, in evening dress, listening good-naturedly to this beautiful music, for which he did not even care. How small and petty it must all seem to him. Laura found time to be astonished. What? She had first met this man haughtily, in all the panoply of her grand manner, and had promised herself that she would humble him and pay him for that first mistrustful stare at her. And now, behold, she was studying him and finding this study quite interesting. Out of harmony, though, she knew him to be with those fine emotions of hers of the early part of the evening. She nevertheless found much in him to admire. It was always just like that. She told herself that she was forever doing the unexpected thing, the inconsistent thing. Women were queer creatures, mysterious even to themselves. Straight away, he made her feel her sex. Now she was just a woman again, with all a woman's limitations, and her relations with Corthell could never be, so she realized, any other than sex relations. With Jadwin, somehow, it had been different. She had felt his manhood more than her womanhood, her sex side. And between them, it was more a give-and-take affair, more equality, more companionship. Corthell spoke only of her heart and to her heart, but Jadwin made her feel, or rather, she made herself feel when he talked to her, that she had a head as well as a heart. And the last act of the opera did not wholly absorb her attention. The artists came and went, the orchestra wailed and boomed, the audience applauded. And in the end, the tenor, fired by a sudden sense of duty and of stern obligation, tore himself from the arms of the soprano and calling out upon remorseless fate and upon heaven and declaiming about the vanity of glory and his heart that broke yet disdained tears, allowed himself to be dragged off the scene by his friend, the bass. For the fifth time during the piece, the soprano fainted into the arms of her long-suffering confidant. The audience, suddenly remembering hats and wraps, bestirred itself, and many parties were already upon their feet and filing out at the time the curtain fell. The Kresslers and their friends were among the last to regain the vestibule. But as they came out from the foyer, where the first draughts of outside air began to make themselves felt, there were exclamations. It's raining! Why, it's raining down here! It was true. Abruptly, the weather had moderated, and the fine, dry snow that had been falling since early evening had changed to a lugubrious drizzle. A wave of consternation invaded the vestibule for those who had not come in carriages, or whose carriages had not arrived. Tempers were lost. Women, cloaked to the ears, quarreled with husbands or cousins or brothers over the question of umbrellas. The vestibules were crowded to suffocation. Here and there in the press, footmen, their top hats in rubber cases, their hands full of umbrellas, searched anxiously for their masters. Outside, upon the sidewalks and by the curbs, an apparently inexorable confusion prevailed. Policemen with drawn clubs, labored and anxious, preoccupied young men, their opera hats and gloves beaded with rain, hurried to and fro, searching for their carriages. At the edge of the awning, the caller, a gigantic fellow in a gold-faced uniform, shouted the numbers in a roaring sing-song that dominated every other sound. Coachmen, their wet rubber coats reflecting the lamplight, called back and forth. Furious quarrels broke out between handsome drivers and the police officers. Deming horses with jingling bits, their backs covered with dark green cloth, plunged and pranced. Carriage doors banged, and the roll of wheels upon the pavement was at the reverberation of artillery caissons. "Get your carriage, sir!" cried a ragged, half-grown Arab at Kressler's elbow. "Hurry up, then," said Kressler. Then raising his voice, for the clamor was increasing with every second, "What's your number, Laura? You girls first? 93? Get that boy, 93, quick now!" The carriage appeared. Hastily, Laura expressed to Mrs. Kressler her appreciation and enjoyment. Corthell saw them to their carriage, and getting in after them, shut the door behind him. Laura sank back in the cool gloom of the carriage's interior, redolent of damp leather and upholstery. "What an evening! What an evening!" she murmured. On the way home, both she and Paige appealed to the artist to hum or whistle for them the arias that had pleased them the most. Each time they were enthusiastic. Yes, yes, that was the air. Wasn't it pretty? Wasn't it beautiful? But Aunt West was still unsatisfied. "I don't see yet," she complained. "Why the young man, the one with the pointed beard, didn't marry that lady and be done with it. Just as soon as they'd seem to have it all settled, he'd begin to take on again and strike his breast and go away. I declare, I think it was all kind of foolish."
"Why, the Duke, don't you see? The one who sang bass,"
Paige labored to explain.
"Oh, I don't like him at all," said Aunt Wess. "He stamped around so, but the audience itself had interested her, and the delicate gowns had been particularly impressing. I never saw such dressing in all my life," she declared. "And that woman in the box next to ours, well, did you notice that?"
She raised her eyebrows and sat her lips together.
"Well, I don't want to say anything."
The carriage rolled on through the darkened downtown streets towards the north side, where the Dearborns lived. They could hear the horses plashing through the layer of slush, mud, half-melted snow and rain that encumbered the pavement. In the gloom, the girls' wraps glowed pallid. The rain left long, slanting parallels on the carriage windows. They passed on down Wabash Avenue and crossed over to State Street and Clark Street. Dark, deserted. Laura, after a while, lost in thought, spoke but little. It had been a great evening, because of other things than mere music. Corthell had asked her to marry him, and she, carried away by the excitement of the moment, had answered him encouragingly. On the heels of this, she had had that little talk with the capitalist Yadwin, and somehow, since then, she had been steadied, calmed. The cold air and the rain in her face had cooled her flaming cheeks and hot temples. She asked herself now if she did really honestly love the artist. No, she did not. And now, as the carriage rolled on through the deserted streets at the business district, she knew very well that she did not want to marry him. She had done him an injustice. But in the matter of righting herself with him, correcting his false impression, she was willing to procrastinate. She wanted him to love her, to pay her all those innumerable little attentions, which he managed with such faultless delicacy. To say,
"No, Mr. Corthell, I do not love you. I will never be your wife,"
would this time be final. He would go away, and she had no intention of allowing him to do that. But abruptly, her reflections were interrupted. While she thought it all over, she had been looking out the carriage window through a little space where she had rubbed the steam from the pane. Now, all at once, the strange appearance of the neighborhood as the carriage turned north from out Jackson Street into LaSalle forced itself upon her attention. She uttered an exclamation. The office buildings on both sides of the street were lighted from basement to roof. Through the windows, she could get glimpses of clerks and bookkeepers in shirt sleeves bending over desks. Every office was open, and every one of them full of a feverish activity. The sidewalks were almost as crowded as though at noontime. Messenger boys ran to and fro, and groups of men stood on the corners in earnest conversation. The whole neighborhood was alive, and this, though it was close upon 1 o'clock in the morning?
"Why, what is it all?" she murmured.
Corthell could not explain, but all at once Paige cried,
"Oh, oh, I know! See, this is Jackson and LaSalle Streets! Landry was telling me the commission district, he called it, and there the broker's office is working overtime! That helmet deal, you know?"
Laura looked suddenly stupefied. Here it was, then, that other drama, that other tragedy, working on there furiously, fiercely through the night, while she and all those others had sat there in the atmosphere of flowers and perfume, listening to music. Suddenly, it loomed portentous in the eye of her mind, terrible, tremendous. Ah, this drama of the provision pits, where the rush of millions of bushels of grain and the clatter of millions of dollars and the tramping and the wild shouting of thousands of men filled all the air with the noise of battle. Yes, here was drama in deadly earnest. Drama and tragedy and death and the jar of mortal fighting. And the echoes of it invaded the very sanctuary of the art, cut athwart the music of Italy and the cadence of polite conversation. And the shock of it endured when all the world should have slept and galvanized into vivid light all these somber piles of office buildings. It was dreadful, this labor through the night. It had all the significance of field hospitals after the battle, hospitals in the tents of commanding generals. The wounds of the day were being bound up, the dead were being counted, while shut in their headquarters, the captains and commanders drew the plans for the grapple of armies that was to recommence with daylight.
"Yes, yes, that's just what it is," continued Paige. "See, there's the rookery, and there's the constable building, where Mr. Helmick has his offices. Landry showed me it all one day."
She raised the flap that covered the little window at the back of the carriage.
"See, down there at the end of the street, that's the Board of Trade building, where the grain speculating is done, where the wheat pits and corn pits are."
Laura turned and looked back. On either side of the vista and converging lines stretched the blazing office buildings. But over the end of the street, the lead-colored sky was rifted a little. A long, faint bar of light stretched across the prospect and silhouetted against this rose a somber mass, unbroken by any lights, rearing a black and formidable facade against the blur of light behind it. And this was her last impression of the evening. The lighted office buildings, the murk of rain, the haze of light in the heavens, and raised against it in the pile of the Board of Trade building, black, grave, monolithic, crouching on its foundations like a monstrous sphinx with blind eyes, silent, grave, crouching there without a sound, without sign of life, under the night and the drifting veil of rain.
Suit cast. We are 120 days into our search for Robinson Crusoe's island. The ship is low on fuel and the crew is getting restless. I'm recording this from our deck looking out at the ocean, and the sea is the color of the sky, KB. It's a terrible inky color. Maybe brings to mind the ink of a money printer. And the waves stretch on forever, an infinitely receding horizon. What a dreadful weight it has on the mind. So I'm here watching the unending rolls of water My mind does slip towards free association. Bear with me here, KB, but I think of the watery grave of the civilization that Plato wrote about, the great fountain of all civilizations. Atlantis, but also of its future construction. The new Atlantis. Is Robinson Crusoe's island Atlantis? But then again, just maybe we shouldn't be here. After all, Plato spoke of Atlantis as beyond the Pillars of Hercules. But didn't Kant himself invoke these pillars in the Critique of Pure Reason, right where he was erecting his limitations? Because on those pillars they were inscribed the words in Latin, nothing beyond.
The continuing adventures of Admiral Edman. This week, the Admiral goes in search of the lost island of Robinson Crusoe in order to discover the forbidden secrets of political economy. This week on Admiral Edman. Brought to you by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, with additional funding from the World Commerce Corporation and Intermaritime Bank, a Bruce Rappaport company.
Even if you've never been to the famed trading pits, chances are you know what they look like and sound like.
Southbound at April of 142!
The trading pits of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange were loud and hectic. On July 6th, the futures pit in Chicago and New York where buying and selling sets the prices for commodities like gold, wheat, and corn, roars one last time. The 167-year-old tradition of open outcry futures operations ends after the closing bell on Monday.
For example, if I'm trying to buy 25 at 4.25, I would be safe and also be hand signals at the same time. And then the opposite person would be saying, okay, I'm selling you 25 at 4.25. So then we'd understand that I was buying and they were selling.
Virginia McGaffey, a grain trader on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange floor, just finished her last shift in the pit. In short, blame the computers. CME Group, which operates the trading pits in New York and Chicago, is shifting to electronic dealing. And CME Group held off on going all digital, even as rivals in New York and London embraced electronic trading.
It's really heartbreaking on a particular level that it's ending this way. And I think in talking with some of the other traders, the fact that we can't leave a legacy to, you know, children and grandchildren, that this is the end of the road, is just definitely not the same on a computer. Not at all.
And not all the pits are closing. One exception is the S&P 500 futures market, which remains open on the Chicago trading floor. And another sign of changing times, fans of CME Group can track the company on several social media sites, including Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest.
Far across the sea, we rejoin our hero aboard the tanker Suitcast, the Panamanian flag flapping resolutely above the good admiral's head through storms and crashing waves. Though far from home and facing unknown peril, Admiral Edman keeps his eyes firm upon the horizon. Though believed by many to be but a legend, the Admiral knows that Robinson Crusoe's forbidden island lurks near at hand through the mist and gales. With only the torn treasure map of William Stanley Jevons to go by, the Admiral persists and moves deeper and deeper into the uncharted economic history.
I hope these messages are being received at HQ. The sky has been blotted out by a cold fog and has persisted for 4 days. The crew is becoming frightened. The sorts of things that might only be whispered in port town bars are discussed freely. Strange superstitions and folk tales. There is a feeling, KB, that the deeper we go into the mist, the deeper into this world of myth and savagery we fall. I must admit that my mind, too, feels as if it is haunted by ghosts. Allow me to indulge in free association, KB. Once again, if you receive my last message, you will know that the Pillars of Hercules, the warning inscribed upon them, is weighed upon my mind. This morning, when waking, I was visited by a memory. an article one read in the good old days, hypothesizing the origins of the dollar sign, the S with the vertical line through it, that it came from a Spanish symbol. This symbol were two pillars, with a banner draped around them like snakes, bearing the Latin words, nothing beyond. The pillars on the symbol were those